Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bridge to China podcast. Bridge to China is a podcast by Humboldt Tech Bridge and ILU. With this podcast, we want to answer the most pressing questions European startups may have when it comes to China. My name is Max Klinschert, and in today's episode, I'm going to speak with Wolfgang Hirn, a journalist and author who has been traveling to China for more than 30 years. We're going to speak about his perception of the developments of the country over the past decades and recently.
So nice to have you here on our today's episode of the Bridge to China podcast. Well, you have been traveling to China since more than 30 years, right?
Yeah, 35.
Exactly. I think your first year was in 86, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, I think it was April 86, just 35 years now, yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy. And if I remember correctly, you were at the time working for the German Manager magazine, right? This was the background of your first visit to China.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, that's so interesting. You basically saw how China was so many years ago and seen all the development over the years. Do you still remember what memory of your first visit to China stuck to you the most? Is there something that you can still remember of it?
A lot of things. It was a completely other world if you compare it with today. There were, of course, a lot of bicycles on the streets, nearly no cars. And if there were cars, it was the old-fashioned model of Volkswagen called Santana. And you saw even farmers coming in from the countryside in the morning selling their product in the city, even in Beijing. And as a foreigner, you have to use your own currency. There was called FEC, foreign exchange currency. You couldn't use the Chinese official currency. You have to use foreign FECs. And it was incredibly cheap at that time. I don't remember the exact amount, but if you went to a restaurant, let me save 2 or 3 German marks, you can have a 3-course dinner with 2 bottles of beer at that time, even in the middle of Beijing. Yeah. And there was only one ATM in whole Beijing where you can use your card, your check card to get some money, some foreign money. One ATM in the whole city of Beijing. So, and there was only one metro line at that time. So it was so completely different from today. It's like looking back into the middle age.
Yeah, that's super interesting. So amazing that you've been able to see also the development since then. I mean, for these decades, you've seen basically how it went from the state that you just described to how it is now, right? And I mean, next to working for the Manager magazine, you also wrote many books about China. And in general, it would be very, very interesting to hear from you how you basically perceived the development of China in regard to the presence of European companies. So like when you first came there, were there already some European companies there, like banks or manufacturers? And how did this then develop over the years that you've been there? Can you tell us a bit about your experience in that regard?
At the end of the 80s, there was no foreign brands at that time. Okay, I mentioned Volkswagen because this was the first joint venture in the car industry, and they started in the mid 80s in a factory near Shanghai, and this was very successful. And all the other car companies moved to China many years later. So and at the end of the 80s or in the beginning of the 90s, you didn't see any foreign brands. Kentucky Fried Chicken was the first American brand long before McDonald's. And I remember when I was, I don't know exactly the year, but I was in a hotel, in the hotel room in Beijing, watching TV and saw the advertising, and I have written down the foreign brands who are advertising in the TV, because this was a sensation. And I remembered it was the first advertising TV, foreign brands I remember was Johnson & Johnson Head and Shoulder. It was a shampoo. So and in the 90s, first the machinery industry came into China. And then after that, let me say, starting with the 2001, when China joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization, more and more consumer good industries and companies are moving into China. Then you saw the first McDonald's, you saw the first Starbucks, all the big retailers of the world came to China, the Metro of Germany, Carrefour of France, Walmart of the United States. And now all consumer brands, luxury brands from all over the world are in China. But this started in the beginning of the 2000s. And in the 90s, the investment goods industry came to China.
Okay. Do you know what the first European company was?
Or if Volkswagen is a European company, it was Volkswagen who came in the mid-80s to China.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, interesting. And also, like, in general, from the perspective that you've had in China, I mean, you wrote a book about Shenzhen. Shenzhen, yes, is basically, yeah, the manufacturing house of China, you could say, the workbench in China.
Not anymore. It's not.
Not anymore?
No. It's not only Shenzhen, or the factory of the world was called the corridor between Shenzhen and Guangzhou, which is 80 kilometers. And so this was the factory of the world until some years ago. There are still factories, but a lot of them moved out to Vietnam or Indonesia, or if they went to the clothing industry, to Bangladesh or India. But now Shenzhen, and the area of Shenzhen, is a high-tech hub, a high-tech center.
Yeah.
And this is a big advantage of Shenzhen. A lot of people are comparing Shenzhen with the Silicon Valley in California, and say Shenzhen is the Silicon Valley of China. Okay, there are a lot of comparisons, Silicon Valley is with the original Silicon Valley, but I would say Shenzhen is the real Silicon Valley of China. And the advantage of Shenzhen in comparison to the Silicon Valley in California is that in Shenzhen you have the software and hardware.
Yeah.
And you have the hardware because all the factories are still there. No, not all of them, but a lot of them are around Shenzhen. So if you have an idea in the morning, you can have a prototype in the afternoon.
Oh, that's crazy. So this is basically how it developed from being the workbench basically to this tech hub that it is now, right?
Yeah, it's a tech hub. If you look, there are many big international Chinese companies which are global, are in Shenzhen. I think the most famous is Huawei. Now everybody knows Huawei because of and Tencent is also based in Shenzhen. And Tencent is a big company who has WeChat, which is this Chinese WhatsApp, although it's much, much better than WhatsApp. Tencent is the big company in Shenzhen, Huawei, and the competitor of Huawei in the telecommunications equipment, ZTE, is also based in Shenzhen. And there is a DJI, I don't know if the people know that. This is one of the
biggest drones,
drone maker.
Yeah.
Drones. They have a market share, global market share of 70-80%. And they started only some years ago. And they are also based in Shenzhen. And there is another, I think, very unknown company called Ping An, which is an insurance company, and this is now the most advanced insurance company concerning technology, and is also based in Shenzhen. So you have in Shenzhen these big companies, but you have also a lot of startups. And this city has a very entrepreneurial spirit. And this combination of big companies and startup culture is creating a very interesting culture and atmosphere in this city.
Mm-hmm.
And you cannot compare it with Shanghai. You cannot compare it with Beijing. This is very typical Shenzhen. And mm-hmm. there are a lot of young people from all over the world are coming to Shenzhen. A lot of people from young people from China, of course, but also a lot of people from all over the world are there. It's a very international city now. It started only 40 years ago when China started with its reform policy at the end of the 70s. At that time, Shenzhen was a conglomerate of some small fisher villages, and 100,000. Nobody knows it exactly. The figure of how many people lived at that time in Shenzhen, but now they are living around about 20 million in Shenzhen.
And what would you say, what fascinated you the most when you first came there, and also now how it developed basically? I mean, you already talked a lot about it, how the startups and the companies and the many young people work there together, but what would you say is the most fascinating thing about Shenzhen?
Yeah, I think this innovative, creative, entrepreneurial culture or climate, it's very different from Europe, or especially Germany. The people are, if you are in Shenzhen, the people, everybody, every young people, the average age is 30 in this city. And they all want to be an entrepreneur, they want to create something, building a company, and so they don't want to work even at Tencent or so. They want to do their own thing, and that's completely different from good old Europe.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, thank you so much for giving us a little insight on Shenzhen. I would also like to talk with you a bit about the latest Chinese 5-year plan. I think it was approved on the 11th of March. So just recently, and it's the 14th 5-year plan China has issued. And it's basically setting out China's vision for social and economic development over the next 5 years, so half a decade. And I wanted to talk with you about it in regard to R&D spending, because this is quite interesting, I think, in this particular plan, and also in regard to sustainability, because it's, I think a pretty important topic. Yeah, so what do you think is the outlook for the country in regard to these two aspects? And what is your general opinion about it?
Well, first I have to say there is still another plan, but beside this 14th, 15th year plan, there is the master plan Made in China 2025. And it's 2025, it's more or less the same as the 5-year plan, also going to 2025. And if you look in both plans, you will see the industries and technologies where China will catch up, or even will get the pole position in the global tech race. And you can see the technologies which China will develop in the next 5 years. And these are, of course, artificial intelligence, which is a very, very hot topic in China, not only in China, but in China more than here in Europe. And if you look to artificial intelligence, a lot of people are saying it's only a race between the United States and China, and Europe is far behind. Okay, this is one point, very important point in the next 5 years, artificial intelligence, but also blockchain is very interesting in China. Quantum computing, biotech, space technology. And they want to create a digital society. And I think they are much more advanced in that sense than we here in Europe. You can see it now in what happens or what not happened in Germany. And I think a big problem is will be in the next 5 years, and that is the shortage of semiconductors and chips. You see it now all over the world that we have problems with chips, but China has a lot of problems with chips because they are very, very dependent on foreign companies. Yeah. And are dependent on Taiwan, on South Korea, on the United States. And this is very dangerous for the Chinese industry because they need these chips. Yeah. And now they want to, and this is one of the big points in the two plans I mentioned, is that they want to build their own semiconductor industry. They have already some companies in this field, but not enough. And so they invest a lot in the semiconductor industry, but it's not so easy to build up a semiconductor industry in 2 or 3 or 5 years. They invest a lot of money in this. The money is not a problem for that, but they have to get the right people. And yeah. They don't have the people in this huge number they need.
Yeah.
But the next 5 years, China want to be an innovation country, innovation nation. That's the main focus of the 14th five-year plan and Made in China 2025. And I think they are on a good direction in on this. Beside the big problem, the semiconductors.
And basically also their goal is to become, as you said, a bit more self-sufficient, especially towards the United States and also Europe, right? And they need to...
I think that because the policy of the Americans, especially under Trump, decision to cut them up from, so they have to be more self-sufficient.
Yeah.
Because of the policy of the Americans.
Yeah, and I think if they continue with investing in the R&D spending, I mean, I checked it. At the moment, they are at a bit above 2% of the GDP that they are spending on R&D. So they are at 2.2%, and only the United States is before them with 3.1%, and we also have Japan and Germany with also 3.2% of GDP spending on the R&D. So I think there's still some room to improvement, right?
Yeah, there is. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's not only a matter of money. I think there's one interesting article in the Harvard Business Review this month, who say that the big advantage of China is that the young, especially the young people, are very adaptive to new technologies, more than in Europe, you know, Germany, and very critical against new technologies. And this is completely different in China.
Yeah. And also one point of the plan I also wanted to discuss with you a bit, and that is basically the climate and CO2 reduction goals. So what they basically decided in the plan is that, they want to reduce GDP energy with 13.5%, and CO2 also with 18% until the end of these 5 years. And also, like, in general, they have the plan to reduce they want to increase their non-fossil fuel consumption of energy to 20% by 2025, and 25% until 2030. So in general, I just wanted to talk with you a bit about it. Do you think that these goals that they have are in line also with other countries, like, for example, Europe or the US? Do you think they could do more? And maybe why are they not doing more? Or maybe what are the restrictions that they have?
They are not in line with the United States or Europe, but because of one reason, the development is, they are on another level of development.
Mm.
It's like, I would say, Germany in the 60s or 70s. So, And the big problem for China is that they are still very dependent on coal. I think now the figure is 55 or 56% of energy is coming from coal. And they want to reduce that. But it takes time. You cannot 5 years to say we reduce coal from 56% to zero, even to 30 or 40%. Okay, they are working on that, reducing coal. They are working on increasing renewables. Mm. They are the biggest producer of energy by solar or by wind, but it's still you mentioned the figures at 20% to get there, and they are increasing the nuclear energy, of course, but they are also called renewable energy. So they are on the way, but it's a long way. And Xi Jinping said, I think it was in November last year, that they want to have carbon neutrality in 2060. Mm. This was very surprising for many people. And it's a very ambitious goal, but I think they are on the way to do that, but it's a long way and it's a very difficult way, because if you're reducing the coal, you have problems in this provinces where the coal is dominating the economy. So there will be people who are laid off. And so you will have some social problems. It's a difficult balance they are facing.
Yeah, I'm also curious how they want to achieve this goal, because this is quite a big goal, of course. But yeah, we will see, definitely. But I want to get back just to summarize your points. So you think that because China has been growing at such a high pace over the last decades, they needed a lot of energy. They needed energy fast. That's why they built a lot of unsustainable energy power plants, like coal power plants. I mean, they have a lot of coal, so I guess this was apparent to them to use coal. And now they are in a position where they are a high-tech country. They have a lot of possibilities also for using renewable energies, but they're still building a lot of coal power plants. Is this still because they can't really sustain the amount of energy that they need with the renewable energies, or what do you think is behind that?
They need this energy, because I'm not an expert in coal, but they are still building coal capacity, but they say this is a very modern kind of coal. But I don't know if this is right. For me, a little bit difficult to talk about. But I think one aspect is very interesting, the e-mobility. They are forcing e-mobility very high speed, and we talked about Shenzhen, and I think this is a model city in that sense, because all public transport, all taxis, cars, and buses, and this is coming more and more in many cities of China, and I think they are number one in selling e-cars in the world, and there are so many companies who are now producing e-cars. It's all the foreign companies are doing that. A lot of new companies in China producing and building e-cars. There are so many brands. I have not the overview how many there are.
Companies.
And now they are coming to Europe.
True. Yeah, I think it's definitely going to be very interesting to see the advancement also in reducing the emissions in China. And yeah, thanks a lot for your insights on that. As a last point before we end our interview, I want to ask you one thing, and this is basically from all your years in China, all the more than 35 years that you've been there now. What was your best memory? What surprised you the most during that time?
Chinese food.
what specifically?
Yeah, the spicy food in Sichuan province or the neighboring Hunan province. But it's difficult to say. I prefer all Chinese food from all regions. If I'm in China, eating in the evening is for me the highlight of every day.
Okay, cool. Yeah, thanks a lot for your insights. Thanks a lot for being on today's episode. And yeah, I hope to speak to you soon in another episode.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Bridge to China, a podcast by Humboldt Tech Bridge. If you want to find out more about what we do, head to our website, humboldt-tech-bridge.com. For feedback, you can write us an email at info@humboldt-tech-bridge.com. This podcast is produced by ILU, the community of European and Chinese changemakers.